Hi, everybody, and Chanukah Sameach. It's a double holiday for us. On the one hand, it's the first day of Chanukah. It's the actual anniversary of the rededication of the temple in the time of Judah the Maccabee in the year 164 BCE. And it is the 29th of November. It's the day on which the United Nations were voted to partition the land of Israel, and to establish an independent Jewish state. The last independent Jewish state was the state created by the Hashmonaim, by the Maccabees, in the 2nd century BCE. So it's not unusual, and it's not certainly appropriate that the two dates should come together. I want to take a break from our usual study of Pirkei Avot. This is Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa, brought to you by the Tel Aviv International Synagogue under the inspired leadership of Rabbi Ariel Constantine. But I want to do history and a little bit of Hashkafa, but not related to Pirkei Avot. It has come to my attention that a lot of people are not really aware of the real Hanukkah story, and that when people ask, what's Hanukkah, they got all kinds of like sort of bland kind of answers. It's the story of the cruise of oil. It's Hanukkah means a lot of carbohydrates. Hanukkah means all kinds of things. It means what else does it mean? It means family. It means warmth. It means brotherhood. There's all kinds of different, different things that pop up. But most people don't know the story. And when people do know the story, they get it from a very political point of view, and they don't really understand the nuances. And since I'm a big believer in nuance, I'd like to relate to you what actually seems to have happened historically, and then we can get an angle on the idea of what it was all about, and so I'd like to call this class, "What is Hanukkah and what?" No sound. Okay, that's weird. That is weird. According to this, there is sound. Can you hear me now? Rabbi Wertheimer, can you hear me now? Tell me yes or tell me no. Okay. All right, let's start again. And I'll edit this before I put it up. Okay, great. I'll edit this before I start up. Before I put it up. Okay, welcome to Tali Pirkei Avot Tisri Hashkafa. This week, we're going to talk about the backstory of Hanukkah, sort of dispel some misconceptions, perhaps add some nuance to the story. So, the story is as follows. Number one, the story really begins not in the year of the outbreak of the revolt against Antiochus, around the year 167, 166. BCE, but rather in the at the end of the 4th century BCE, when Alexander the Great conquered the land of Israel and conquered most of the world. He had an empire that led from the Balkans to Egypt, to all of the Middle East, parts of Africa, and not just Egypt, all the way to Afghanistan. Those of you who might have seen the movie, I keep quoting old movies. Those of you who might have seen the movie The Man Who Would Be King, that action takes place way at the outer reaches of Alexander's empire out in apparently Pakistan or Afghanistan, something like that. That's as far as Alexander went. In any event, Alexander, when he conquered, was motivated by basically two ideas. One was, of course, just to build an empire. That's what, you know, empire builders do. But he was very much motivated by a vision. He was, perhaps because he wasn't a native Greek, he was Macedonian. but and he wanted to prove something. But he was very much enamored. He was more than enamored. He was burning with zeal for the dissemination of Greek culture in its broadest sense. A lot of people don't know that Aristotle was his personal tutor. I can't imagine he was such a friendly person from my reading studies of Aristotle, but anyways. Aristotle was a personal teacher. He was a person with a vision of universal culture and civilization which will bind all of mankind under the aegis of sort of a Hellenic sacred canopy. And it was he who started the ideal, or initiated the ideal, of what was known as Hellenism, which is a merger of Eastern culture, which is basically transformed by its encounter with and its merging with the height of Greek civilization. Not unlike the way that colonialists in the 19th century, French and German and Belgian and British, not only carved themselves out empires throughout the globe, but also wanted to instill their own individual culture among the inhabitants of the places that they conquered. Partly out of conviction, partly out of convenience, certainly the elites of this broad empire that that Alexander built, got with the program. They wanted to make it. They wanted to make it, and they were sure they were convinced of the superiority, to a large degree, of Greek life. And the truth of the matter is that pagan culture is extremely tolerant. Once you have more than one god, what's it matter how many more gods you have, right? And certainly the elites of all of these countries, this vast empire, were very happy to become more and more Hellenic. The only people with whom there was a potential problem was with the Jews. Largely because Hellenistic culture is pagan. I mean, everything was pagan. I mean, even the arts were associated with the worship of the gods. Theater and never mind sports were all connected with pagan worship, and which made them, given the absolute rejection of polytheism, and never mind representation of God, of a god, by the Torah, that inability to be able to embrace Hellenistic culture totally was already presented problems early. However, it's also a fact that the reaction to the Hellenistic rulers of the land of Israel, first the Egyptians and later the Syrian Greeks, was muted. I mean, it was sort of it wasn't all of a piece. Basically. You could divide the Jewish population, for example, of the land of Israel, into three parts. You had the extremes. So on the one hand, you had pious Jews who saw and rejected, fundamentally rejected, anything and everything that had to do with Greek culture as fundamentally pagan and an anathema to the Torah. That's one group. At the other end were people who were part of the upper class in Judea, but also living on the other side of the Jordan, who said, you know what, we have a real problem. What's the problem? The problem is that the major obstacle to the success and the advancement of our lives as part of this great progressive enlightened empire is the fact that we still adhere to regressive, and I'm using the words on purpose, regressive and narrow-minded and primitive notions of God and of national and national identity and so on. And the truth of the matter is that Jewish otherness is a serious problem which we have to overcome. This is expressed, obviously, with an agenda by the author of one of the major sources that we have for the for the Maccabean Revolt, and that is the Book of Maccabees, especially the first one. In the first chapter, we have the following statement. This is verse 14 and verse 15. In those days there went out of Israel wicked men who persuaded many, saying, "Let us go and make a covenant with the heathen that are round about us, for since we departed from them, we have had much sorrow." In other words, our problem is our separateness. Our problem is our particularism. We have to become universalists, become like everybody else, and adopt the new values of the Greeks and the Hellenists. In the middle, as usual, was the majority, apparently. Here I'm basing myself on what seems to be the consensus among historians, who were perfectly happy to pick and choose. In other words, they didn't see any reason to totally reject everything that the Greeks and the Hellenists tried to advance, but were not willing to go as far as these extreme Hellenizers were advocating. And the truth of the matter is that while that led to tension within the Jewish community and the elites who ruled in Transjordan and in Jerusalem were increasingly identified with the more radical Hellenizers, by the same token, most people weren't willing to make a big deal about the events. Now here, I'm going to have to skip a lot of details, but here I'm going to recommend the major works about the history of the period. First of all, you should read Maccabees 1. If you read Hebrew, there's the commentary of Professor Daniel Schwartz, which is just represents the last word or the almost last word on the topic. There's a wonderful book by Hanan Eshel on these and the House of the Hasmoneans, which I recommend and which were served me for as the basis for what I'm saying. In English, there's less, but if you write me on a private message, I'll try to send you some things that are appropriate. In any event, this tense situation continued until the coronation of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Now, in the first part of the period after Alexander had conquered the Middle East, Egypt had ruled the land of Israel in the year 200. It had been, or 199 actually, had been conquered by Antiochus III, who represented a different Syrian Greek dynasty. And he apparently was willing to, was actually pretty pro-Jewish in the sense that he didn't pursue a consistent or a radical Hellenizing agenda. Antiochus is a different type. Antiochus was a different type of person. First of all, he was apparently a very enthusiastic Hellenizer, a Hellenist. He believed, he was a real true believer in the vision and the beauty of Greek civilization. Not unlike, by the way, it's interesting, later on, a person who actually fomented also an anti-Jewish revolt and anti-Jewish legislation, the Emperor Hadrian, was a similar kind of mind in terms of his cultural orientation, a very aggressive, very enthusiastic kind of Hellenizer. Anyways, Antiochus IV was a person who actually dreamed of binding together his entire empire under the aegis of the sort of deep-seated and deep-seated Greek civilization. At the same time, so as a result, he was a natural ally for the radical Jews who really wanted to become Hellenists. They wanted to be like everybody else. It's a principled position. You shouldn't think that these are, the author of Maccabees 1 said that they were wicked people, but, this is a principled position. We believe in assimilation. We believe in universalism. We believe everybody should be the same. We believe that that circumcision is child abuse. We believe that worshiping all the gods is an act of universal humane position, outlook on life. Anyways, so they were natural allies. And As a result of a combination of cultural, political, and economic motives, Antiochus ended up legislating a series of unprecedented decrees against the Jewish religion. What happened was, What happened was this. He had installed in Jerusalem a radical high priest who was the suspected leader of the Jewish people, a radical Hellenizing high priest, and then went off to conquer Egypt. Now, at the time, Egypt was, while formerly ruled by the Ptolemaean Greeks, was effectively enthralled to Rome, and it was perhaps the most important acquisition that Rome had had made in the previous 50, 60 years, for the simple reason that Egypt, it's hard to believe this, was the breadbasket of Rome. Increasingly, more and more people lived in Rome who were not employed or did not have sufficient income to be able to acquire bread. Italy did not produce enough wheat, enough grain, bichlal, to be able to feed its population. And Rome needed Egyptian wheat in order to be able to feed its the mob. They were bread and circuses, so the bread came from Egypt. Rome could not tolerate another empire or another power, especially one which was actually hostile to it, to control Egypt. So when Antiochus came in to conquer Egypt, or beat the Ptolemies, Rome went in and humiliated him. Roman ambassador, according to the story, drew a line around Antiochus and said, take as much time as you want, but you're not leaving the circle until you withdraw from Egypt. Now, Antiochus knew very well he couldn't beat the Romans. The Romans were already clearly the rising power in the West, and so he withdrew humiliated. Now, word reached Jerusalem, not only that he had been humiliated, but he had died. So the Jews in Jerusalem rose up against this Hellenizing Kohen Gadol, replaced him with a moderate high priest, moderately Hellenizing high priest, named Jason, and celebrated his death. Antiochus showed up, and turns out he's not dead, and he lost it. So he threw out this Jason, put back Menelaus, his guy. And first of all, then he plundered the temple treasury, and he decided the only way to be able to deal with the Jews is to get rid of Judaism and force them to become Hellenists. That'll ensure their loyalty and also bring about the realization of his vision for homogeneous universal civilization. And so he banned circumcision, which was seen as an anathema. In a Greek world which worshipped the body, to go in and advance and harm the human body, to damage the human body, would seem to as just absolutely intolerably barbaric. The study of Torah was forbidden, all kinds of things, and Jews were proactively required to worship idols, worship Zeus, and it's against that background, and the temple itself was desecrated. It was dedicated to Zeus Olympus. Where exactly they put the statue is a matter of some dispute. But the point is, the temple was then dedicated to Zeus Olympus. Not unlike the way that Hadrian later dedicated Jerusalem to Jupiter Capitoline, and he named the city after himself. Aelius was the gens name of Hadrian. Same kind of procedure. There's a reason I'm mentioning this, because for Chazal, the two persecutions sort of merge into one. Stories from one you carry to the other one, and so on. In other words, the story, for example, of the story of the woman and her seven children, whose name was apparently Miriam, Nachana, or according to one version anyways, it apparently happened at the time of the Maccabees, not the time of Hadrian, which is when it's later discussed. In any event, this was an unprecedented situation, historically and in Jewish history. Never before in the history of mankind had there been this kind of religious persecution seeking to wipe out the faith. partly because paganism, again, is eclectic. There's no reason, you know, you have one god, you have the other gods. There's no reason to say, it's either or. But when you have one god, you believe in monotheism, the Torah's whole message is against polytheism, then you're in a situation where if somebody comes and says to you, die, you will. If you don't worship idols, I will kill you. It becomes an unprecedented situation. So it was at that moment, for the first time in Jewish history, that Jews had to deal with the question of, what do you do in a situation like that? Is there such a thing as martyrdom? Martyrdom was intuitively created by from among the Jewish people. It didn't come from the bottom down. It came from the top down. It came from the bottom up, and that's patently clear from all the sources that we have. Martyrdom was created by the Jews as a response to the persecutions of Antiochus. So that's number one. In response, and it was against that background, they have the famous story of Matityahu, who, when the officers of the king came to Modi'in, which is apparently now, there's a big debate about it for a long time, but now it seems that the city of Modi'in today more or less sits on the site of ancient Modi'in. Came with a statue of Zeus and commanded the Jews to sacrifice to it. When a Jew offered to do so, the Matityahu killed the quisling and said Mi Lashem Eloi and declared the revolt open. What's striking here is two things. Number one, that it was the edicts of Antiochus against the Jewish religion, which forced all of the people in the middle. In other words, all the moderate Hellenizers. You want to call them modern Orthodox? That's fine with me. All the moderate Hellenizers who said there's nothing as long as we don't have to give up our religion, our faith, and our memories and our relationship there. Whatever the case might be, you know, we can have Greek names and we can take advantage of the best of Greek society. When that became a question of you have to choose between Judaism and Greek civilization, that's what pushed the majority of the Jews into the camp of those who had always opposed everything from the beginning, and that's what made the revolt feasible and viable, and in the end successful. That's number one. Number two, the fact that Matityahu killed this person who wanted to worship Zeus does point out the fact that this was all, it wasn't just a civil war, but it was also a civil war. If you wanted a good example, it's like the American Revolution. The American Revolution was a revolt against Britain and British rule. However, many American colonists supported Britain, and as a result, they made common cause with the British and fought the British. And therefore, in those circumstances, there was civil strife as well, and people killed each other over ideals that they felt were a matter of life or death. So that element is here as well. I've been watching, unfortunately, spending too much time with this since I have two articles I have to finish. But those who would reduce the whole story to simply a civil war between Jews missed the point and they're distorting the point. This was a revolt against extreme oppression by Antiochus, which was abetted by, maybe a little bit, somewhat fomented by other Jews, but this was certainly not primarily or overwhelmingly a civil war. In the end, Judah knew exactly how to run a good guerrilla war, and a year after the temple had been defiled. In 164 BCE, it was reconquered and rededicated on the 25th of Kislev. So, I started by saying, what is Hanukkah and what isn't Hanukkah? So, Hanukkah is not the Jewish Christmas. Hanukkah is not a festival of universal homogeneity, cultural homogeneity. It is the opposite of human. It is the lesson of Hanukkah is that once that the Jewish people historically, while largely appreciative of non-Jewish culture and the non-Jewish world, refused to cross a line which would have required them to give up their integrity as a separate, unique people with their own vision of reality and their own value and value system and their own national vision. That's number one. In other words, it is a celebration of particularism in the face of cultural colonialism and cultural aggression. Number two, it is a holiday in which is very hard to think about today because we don't think in those terms. But it is a holiday which at the same time teaches that there are some things you fight for. And there are some things you're willing to die for. As I said, martyrdom was not dictated by the rabbis or by the proto-rabbis or the religious leaders of the age, whoever they were at the time. Matityahu was apparently one of them. But rather, they were a natural response by the people. One of the striking things about the stories of martyrdom that come up in the first few chapters of Maccabees 1 and almost all of Maccabees 2 is the way that defiance of Antiochus's edicts came from the simple people. Even when the defiance didn't have to happen. In other words, so circumcision was banned because it's considered to be child abuse and because it's a violation of the adoration of the body, which was so central to Greek culture. That's true. On the other hand, who needed to know? Women, according to the first two books of Maccabees, made a point of publicizing the fact that they were circumcising their children. In other words, it was a very strong in-your-face protest element to the response of the people. On the contrary, it's really striking that if you look at the patterns of martyrdom emerge from the Book of Maccabees, and you compare them to the established Jewish legal consensus under what circumstances should you commit martyrdom? I mean, rules that were developed much later. You see that the rabbis are trying to control the impulse of the people. The people were willing to die for kashrut, and they're willing to die for bit milah, and they're willing to die for Shabbat, and they're willing to die for study of Torah. And the rabbis reduced it. They say, this is too much already. So they reduced it to the only time that you should actually allow yourself to be martyrdom, past tense, is when you are when it's demanded of you to either worship idols or later on to apostatize, to convert to another religion, to kill somebody else, or to violate one of the sexual rules of, it's not just incest, one of the rules of sexual, one of the forbidden sexual liaisons which are mentioned in the Torah. That's it. Other than that, life conquers all. But that's not what people wanted to hear. There's a situation. There was one story in the Book of Maccabees where an old man is told he must, you know, they want to force him to eat pork. Apparently, pork that had been offered to an idol, but not clear. And the guy said, "No, I won't do it." And one of his students, who had become an enthusiastic Hellenizer, a member of the Evsexia, if you want, says, "Listen, I want to save your life. I'll give you a piece of kosher meat, but we'll pretend that it's pork, and people will say you ate pork." He said, "No, kill me first." Now, that's not, the Torah doesn't demand that. Now, later halacha doesn't demand that. But this shows you just how, from what depths of fortitude and of self-assertion and pride in the Jewish heritage motivated these really pioneer martyrs to say to Antiochus and his associates and those who supported him among the Jews, no. So Hanukkah is a holiday of particularism, not of universalism. Hanukkah is also a celebration of the connection between us and the land of Israel. I don't mean to say that. Is that political? Well, insofar as Judaism and Jewish history is the story of the of a particular country and a particular people in a particular territory, yeah, I guess it's political. But there is no question that the Hanukkah story does ultimately lead to, and Maimonides says this explicitly, and he's not the most political guy you'd want. Maimonides says this in the way he, when he recounts the story of Hanukkah in the laws of Hanukkah. It's about Jewish independence in the land of Israel. This is summed up in a letter that was sent by the last surviving Maccabee brother, Simon, around the year 140 CE. Now, it was about 25 years after the temple was rededicated. In the interim years, basically, what happened was many Jews weren't so clear that they wanted independence from the Greeks. They were willing to have autonomy as long as their religion was protected, or their religious rights were protected. And in the end, the Hasmoneans convinced the people and won independence from the Syrian Greeks, because there was no way to guarantee our religious rights without having political power and political independence. In a letter that Simon the Hashmonai sends to Antiochus VII, who in the end recognized, like George III, recognized Judean independence, he wrote a letter as follows. This is from Maccabees 1, chapter 15, verses 33 to 34. Simon says to him in reply, quote, "We have neither taken foreign land nor seized foreign property, but only the inheritance of our ancestors, which at one time had been unjustly taken by our enemies. Now that we have had the opportunity, we are firmly holding the inheritance of our ancestors," unquote. It's interesting. That's where it led. And it is appropriate that the first day of Hanukkah this year coincides with the 29th of November, which began the... which marks the anniversary of the partition vote in the UN in 1947, which reestablished the polity that had been lost after the loss of independence, some 80 years after this letter was sent to Antiochus. So, that's probably a lot to think about, what Hanukkah is and what it isn't. Don't get too heavy. Don't get too heavy in terms of thinking it's a holiday. And second, don't get too heavy. Don't eat too many sufganiyot or latkes. But everybody enjoy. Chag Orim Sameach, Festival of Lights. Have a happy Festival of Lights. Have a happy Hanukkah. And we will see you next time.